Well, Antarctica changes, and sometimes you look out, and in all four directions, it's endless white. It's not particularly flat. It's full of snow ridges. The snow is, you know, rock hard, and you just see endless waves of snow. And, you know, you've got this heavy sled behind you, 240 pounds, and you think, how am I going to drag this? And am I getting any closer to the pole? There's nothing to mark distance. So it can be emotionally very debilitating.
There are mountains, right?
There are.
What do they look like?
The mountains are, when you do pass them, you don't see them all the time, but when you do pass them, they're called nunataks, because they are, although very tall, they're covered in snow to a huge degree, so they look kind of stunted. So you're going through some of these spectacular mountain ranges, but they're, in a sense, stunted in their growth and their majesty. So they're different, but it is, you know, sort of a rocky crag that you'll ski along and you'll see in the distance, and it changes the scenery, and it lifts for a period of time. We skied along an area called the Thiel Mountains, and although they were quite a ways to our right in the distance, they were sort of a traveling companion for about 5 days. And it was very sad, in a sense, to start to pass them where you'd have to look over your shoulder, your right shoulder, and look back and watch them, you know, get smaller and smaller as the days would pass. And then pretty soon you lost that companion. But it felt like an actual traveling companion for a period of time. We want to cross the continent from a very different place, starting place, from the edge of the continent, and we want to go to the South Pole, get there sometime around Christmas of 2000, keep on trekking right down to the other end of the continent, down at the Ross Sea, and come out sometime mid-February of 2001. We're going to be on skis, pulling sleds. We're guessing our sleds at this stage, it's still early, so our plans might change a little bit, but we're hoping our sleds stay at around 250 pounds. And we're going to use wind canopies when the wind is favorable and try and make extra miles. It's about 2,100 miles.
Is that like a sail?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's sort of a parasail is what most people are familiar with, sort of a rectangular kind of sail.
Why do you want to do this?
I tried to do this in 92-93 with AWE and got stopped at the pole, and so it's just been something I've been chewing on for a long time.
Why just two people?
Two people, it was really something that I came away with from the last trip, in that the traverse is a huge amount of miles to make in a very short period of time. You've got basically from the beginning of November for the Antarctic summer's beginning to mid-February to do the traverse. That's a lot of real estate to travel across in a very short period of time. And so what I came away with from the last trip is that four is actually a very large team. I still am intrigued about traveling with a team, but when I stood at the South Pole in 93, I decided I would return with one other person. Wasn't sure who that person would be at that time, but knew I would travel with one other, and that we could travel very quickly with just the two of us. That means one tent, you know, a decision-making body all under one roof kind of thing. And I'm just really not interested in the solo attempt at this point. Part of what intrigues me about the crossing is the crossing itself and the challenges that it provides, but also, again, how to work with another individual to achieve that goal.
A lot of explorers have said that going on the expedition is actually a relief, that the fundraising ahead of time is maybe the hardest part. How much money do you need to raise for this? How's it going?
We need to raise over a couple $1 million to actually do all that we're trying to do, both on the ice and here. And
I know with the 92-93 AWE, you faced fundraising problems because you're a woman and there was no man on the trip. And I think you've said that if there's people told you if you had a man on the trip, you'd be able to make more money.
Yeah.
That's true, isn't it?
Well, it certainly sometimes seemed to be easier. I mean, if you know, when people say that exact, you know, phrase to you, that certainly gives you that feeling that if you had a man on the trip, it would be less of an issue.
So is that a handicap now, in fundraising terms only?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I think that it's gotten better. I've been back for 6 years. You know, debt is part of an expedition's history and legacy, I think. If you look at every expedition, there's always been some issue. So the women's part was certainly a big factor in the 92 expedition. But I do see movement in that. I do see an acceptance of female athletes and companies coming on board to want to help women athletes achieve at greater distances, you know, to do more. The WNBA is an example. The America's Women's Cup, Mighty Mary sailing some years ago for the first time, an all-women's team coming into play. Fast pitch. These kinds of things have helped a great deal, I think, society's perceptions about what women can do. And I think that that's been the real juggernaut in the past, is that, you know, they look at us, I'm 5'3", you know, 120 pounds, and they say, how can you carry 250 pounds? There's just no way. And if something were to happen to you as a woman, we would be, you know, branded irresponsible for taking you on. It is a high-risky sponsorship. There are no guarantees that we'll achieve everything that we set out to do. You've got the two, you know, most prominent polar women on the globe attempting this, so our chances, I think, are quite high. Convincing corporations who don't know a whole lot about this kind of thing is another challenge.